You're listening to Scratching and Thriving Podcast on Exposure TV Network. I'm Dr. A, an educator and entrepreneur.
And I'm Brandon, a healthcare executive and lifestyle guru. And we are two longtime friends who are passionate professionals committed to empowering people to thrive both professionally and personally. Ladies and gentlemen and listeners, welcome to Scratching and Thriving Podcast. And on today's show, we have Vice Chancellor Douglas Haynes from the University of California, Irvine. Welcome, Vice Chancellor Haynes. We're glad to have you.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to our interview today.
Awesome. Awesome. So I really want to start by you giving a little bit of your background so that everybody gets to know you a little bit.
Okay, well, I'll start at the beginning. Born and raised in San Francisco, but I've spent about 30 years here in Orange County in Southern California, where I'm a faculty member, a professor of history, and vice chancellor for equity, diversity, and inclusion at UCI. I can say that I've seen the state, the country, and the campus change over that three-decade period.
So tell us about that. Tell us what changes you've seen on the campus over your 30-year period.
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question because it's quite striking. Okay. When I joined UCI in 1992 as a very young assistant professor with a lot more hair, there are 15,000 students. Now okay. There are 45,000. So it's doubled in size. And what strikes me to this day is that when I moved and relocated to Orange County from the Bay Area, which has far more Black people than Orange County, I expected it to be a different experience. What's happened in that three-decade period is the population has changed in Orange County.
Okay.
So it's a majority-minority population. The overall percentage of Black people remains, compared to the Bay Area, low, about 2%. But I think that the broad change really gave me and gives me a lot of hope about possibilities, particularly for Black people to thrive in Orange County.
So I did look you up prior to the interview, and I noticed that you did a lot of studying abroad.
Yes, I did.
And I was very interested in some of your writings, your publications. You talked about a lot of healthcare related publications.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a healthcare executive here in Mississippi. And of course, you know, here recently it's been very difficult
absolutely.
To do that role, considering the pandemic, the shortages and all that. In your studies, how would you compare the U.S. healthcare system to those of other countries, country of your choice?
Well, I would say it's riddled with contradictions.
Okay.
As you know, and as most people know, that we spend far more money, a greater percentage of our gross national product on healthcare. Mm-hmm. But the quality of healthcare for the vast majority of people is very different. In fact, other countries deliver healthcare to a larger percentage of the population for a lot less, right? And so the question becomes, how is it possible that we're spending all this money and yet we have millions of people who are completely without health insurance at all, and many people who are underinsured? And part of it is the unique set of circumstances of the United States, right? Where healthcare has not been regarded as a right. And for a long time has always been tethered to where you work.
Right. And considered a privilege.
Exactly. A benefit. And so if you live in a society that historically and still continues to treat Black people differentially, they're going to have differential access to healthcare.
Very true.
And some states, they are quite happy to participate in the Affordable Health Care Act. But what's striking is that if you look at voting patterns, particularly in 2008 and 2012 and thereafter, many voters voted down the Affordable Health Care Act when it was associated with former President Barack Obama. So they were prepared to accept it. But once it was identified with the first Black president of the United States, states voted it down. It boggles the mind.
So almost cut off your nose to spite your face.
You know, we've been doing that for a long time in this country. Mm-hmm. And often the spite is directed at Black people.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Tell us a little bit more about the UCI Black Thriving Initiative and how that started.
Well, first, thank you for asking that question, because the Black Thriving Initiative is both an example of change and continuity. And so our campus has been committed to inclusive excellence, a very broad definition of excellence, that we define excellence by the contours of the diversity of our students, of our employees. But in 2020, in the wake of the killing of George Floyd and others before and after him, we decided to do something different. And what was different is the Black Thriving Initiative. And so it is about mobilizing the capacity of a multi-billion-dollar, highly ranked research university to build a culture where Black people thrive as undergraduates and graduate students, faculty, career staff, and communities that we serve. And I think that for far too long, people just assume that this happens automatically. And the reason why we launched it is for two reasons. We want to be the nation's foremost destination for Black people to thrive. And two, anti-Blackness poses an existential threat to our mission as a public research university. In other words, if we don't confront anti-Blackness, we cannot fulfill our obligation as a public research university. And so when we look at the Black Thriving Initiative, it consists of three parts. They work together and reinforce each other. The first is culture change that is grounded in confronting anti-Blackness wherever teaching and learning and healing takes place. And at the core of it is the idea that accountability begins with understanding. So it's not enough to say Officer Chauvin in Minneapolis, Minnesota is a bad officer, right? That's the tip of the iceberg. Right? It requires people who are interested and curious to learn about the Black experience and the drivers of well-being. And so we've rolled out a series of programs in support of that. And the key thing to keep in mind is that we're a university within a university. There's 50,000 people here. Not just students, our learners. Our 20,000 staff members, our learners, right? And so we wanted to open this up to everybody. We also launched a Black Thriving Pledge. Four things: acknowledge the existence of anti-Blackness, understand your relationship to micro and macroaggressions, appreciate the labor that Black people expend to navigate bias, prejudice, and bigotry, and fourth, confront anti-Blackness. We don't want people to lose their jobs. We're not asking people to sort of sacrifice their lives. We want them to be agents on behalf of Black thriving where they are. But you can't be an agent on behalf of Black thriving if you don't understand it, if you don't understand the history, if you don't understand your relationship to systemic racism. The second platform is leveraging our research and teaching mission to purposefully advance understanding about the Black experience and drivers of well-being in support of Black communities. And I have to tell you, as I was doing research and developing the Black Thriving Initiative, most universities don't know what they're doing around advancing the Black experience or understanding the drivers. There's no comprehensive understanding. And so we decided we need to mobilize ourselves, right? And so we've rolled out an extensive array of funded programs for a cluster hiring program where we're hiring faculty who are dedicated to this. We have existing faculty doing work in it. We want to add to them. And so our first area of research activity is understanding environmental health disparities, right? Everywhere. The second thing we did is we created a set of what we call term chairs. These are chairs that are really that recognize distinguished contributions in research, teaching, and service that supports the concept of Black thriving. And so we awarded five of them in business, law, history, criminology, as well as political science. And these chairs are associated with a large dollar award of $90,000. And so we're putting our money where our mouth is, right? I think the third area has to do with the community. And so one thing to keep in mind is that when you look out at the top 25 research universities in the United States, right? That includes all the eight Ivies and others. We enroll more Black students in Orange County than 2/3 of them. We enroll more Black students than Stanford does, than Princeton, than Yale. Right? They should do more. They have more resources, more capacity. But part of the Black Thriving Initiative is to prioritize this. And so we want to engage more. We want to describe what we're doing to families and communities so they understand that we are engaged in transforming and that when they trust us with their child, with to come and study at UCI, we want them to thrive, and we're going to do our level best to help them to thrive.
You know, you said so many things that I want to touch on.
I'm sorry, you got me going.
Right. Well, and so where I specialize in healthcare, Adrian is higher ed. So this is her thing, just okay. FYI. So she could talk about higher ed all day.
All day. And, okay. You know, one of the things that you said is many higher ed institutions do not make the Black student population or their Black employees or the Black population an imperative, right? And I would agree with you because it often gets embedded into the EDI work or DEI work, whatever framework you decide to use. And so I guess, you know, I'm curious as to how you got the institution to focus so heavily in this area. But I'm also curious, do you think that EDI work or DEI work to some degree undermines the opportunities for the Black students at the institution because they're just one of many and there's no emphasis or focus on their specific needs?
I think that's an amazing question. And I'm going to put it another way. The question is, is the commitment to diversity sufficient? And the answer is no. It's necessary, but not sufficient. A commitment to diversity, I think most people would agree, but that's not enough. Because if you're serious about Black thriving, you need to understand who your community is. And so we ask ourselves four questions. Who is our community? Are they thriving? How do we know? and how can we improve? And so I think that to the extent that the EDI work is not only promoting EDI, but also creating an expectation that we need to be specific, right? We need to be specific. And I have to give credit to my chancellor, Howard Gilman, because he made it clear as we were processing that recorded killing of George Floyd as a cabinet, as a campus, as a community, he made it very clear, this has to be about Black people, right? And I wanna say something else, and this might sound odd to listeners outside of California, but I want you to lean in on this, that it's actually legal for Black people to thrive. It's legal.
That is necessary to say, unfortunately.
It is legal. Mm-hmm. And so that means it's legal for institutions to ask the question, who is our community? Mm-hmm. Are they thriving? How do we know and how can we improve? Black thriving benefits everybody. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it all depends on how the EDI work is configured. And I think that a very powerful role for EDI, at least, and I'm not saying we're the example, but how it's configured here is that it has to include everybody. It has to include everybody. Everybody, and I know that's a more aspirational goal, should be interested in Black people thriving because we can't do it by ourselves.
That's true.
And I want to say something else, because often these discussions can go in a lot of different directions. Some people say, is it legal? Yes, it is. Other people says, why are you doing them and not them? It's important to understand that there are Black gay people. So if LGBT issues is your thing, they're Black gay people, transgender people, gender non-binary, or if veterans are your thing, they're Black veterans. If poverty alleviation is your thing, they're poor Black people. Over half the population are women. There are Black women. So if the thing for you that gets your boat moving is gender equity, apply it to Black women.
I agree. I think the work that you all are doing is fantastic. I do want to pivot the conversation a little bit to critical race theory. All of the fun that is occurring around that these days.
I like your sense of humor.
So for those who don't know what this is, give us the definition of critical race theory.
Okay. Recall. It emerged in the 1970s. Now remember, this is the period after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act. And those pieces of legislation really were the first time that the federal government took responsibility for ensuring the rights of Black people, among others. Right. And so a lot of people thought, you know what, we're done. We passed these two heavy pieces of legislation, including the Fair Housing Act of 1968. Right? But what scholars, particularly in the legal field, determined was that you could have racial injustice on a systemic level. Mm-hmm. Right? And so critical race theory refers to a way of understanding our world and our society and how it's organized. It's easy to think that when you look at the uneven distribution of power and authority, of wealth, of home ownership, as a product of individuals making bad decisions. But critical race theory sees inequality as the outcome of processes that are often described as objective, neutral. For example, competition in the marketplace. That helps to explain why there's rich people, why there's poor people. If you work hard and smart, you get rich. Or in healthcare, why is it that Black people are often at higher risks of cancer? Very often learn about their condition when it's too late, when the therapeutical interventions are limited. Some might say, well, it's because they're not paying attention. Or you might look at, why is it that Black people represent something like 13% of the general population of the United States, but close to a third of all the inmates across the country? And so what critical race theory does, it shows how these systems and structures produce these outcomes, right? To put it another way, in California, the Golden State, we're a part of the University of California, the greatest public research university in the world. In 2021, 4% of all the undergraduates are Black. 4%. If you look at our prison system, 30%, 30% of the inmate population in California's correction system are Black men and women. And so some might say, well, look, Black folks just don't compete, so they don't get into the greatest public research university in the world. But apparently they do get into prison. Critical race theory says that's not an accident. Right? That's not an accident. Now, part of the politics around it is that most people can't even spell critical race theory who are opposed to it.
Right.
They're just using this as just a proxy for so many other things, to cover up their own racism, to try to divert attention from the fact that 4% of our undergraduates in the University of California are Black in the 21st century.
That is staggering.
Or 30% of the inmate population in the Golden State is Black. And so it's easy in a number of states, particularly like in Arizona, and I think a few throughout the Midwest and the South, to pass at the Board of Education level, at the state level, legislation that says you can't teach critical race theory. But I just want to underscore something. I learned Black history from my parents. And what we call critical race theory today, that's what they were teaching. When they told me to take pride in my heritage, that's critical race theory. When they told me that, you know what, the systems that we're part of make us do more.
Can you talk about with that? Because oftentimes what I will hear people say is we prefer culturally responsive teaching over critical race theory. And the two are not exclusive.
Exactly.
But can you talk about why?
It all depends. It all depends. So culturally responsive may be, I'm going to produce a curriculum that actually addresses the history of the United States. And by the way, slavery was intrinsic to the making of the United States. Now, you might think that's critical race theory, but actually it is a consensus opinion among hundreds, if not thousands, of historians, right? Now, some might call that culturally responsive, right? Because you may have Black people in the classroom. You may have Black people in the school district, right? It's the truth. critical race theory is the same thing. And I think often, you know, the real challenge isn't just the right wing, because they got to do their thing. They have to figure out a way to eat, right? The real challenge is the willingness of people to see themselves in relationship to Black people, right? It's easy for folks to say, I completely love LeBron James, right? But they don't know anything about his community, right? And I just think it's not so much the name, critical race theory, cultural responsive teaching. I think basically it's about being interested and seeing yourself in relationship to Black people. I think, like I suggest, it just depends on what people's intentions are, but I think they overlap.
Changing gears just a little bit.
Sure.
What is your perspective on the difference between equity, diversity, and inclusion?
I'm glad you asked that question too, because these aren't just slogans. Although sometimes people invoke them, but they actually have a lot of meaning. Equity refers to creating an affirmative and supportive environment, right? That someone is thinking about you, and that thinking is informed in terms of the experience of the educational pipeline, right? So equity is something that people should expect, right? It's not a gift. It should never be a gift. It's an example of an institution's commitment in you thriving. Diversity is related but different. It sort of recognizes the heterogeneity of people that compose a community, an organization, a country, a nation, you name it. But it's not enough to say, hey, we have the whole rainbow. You actually need to understand the people. You know, it's so disappointing when people invoke diversity, and then you look at the responses from, let's say, staff at many of our corporations, and they don't feel respected. And so inclusion is related but different, because that is about creating a sense of belonging, right? You know, a president can't make people do that, right? And so it's about building connections. And that means you have to be willing to take a risk, right? You have to be willing to say, I'm interested in learning about you. Would you give me that opportunity? And I have to tell you both, I mean, it's everyone's committed to equity, diversity, inclusion. You ask anybody in the street, whether we're talking about Mississippi or California, New York or Texas, everyone says, yeah, I'm down for it. But if you ask people if they belong, you get a different response. So, I mean, that's how I define equity, diversity, inclusion at UCI. And I want to be humble here. It's a work in progress. It's a work in progress. Because, you know, if you're Black and gay, for example, in the United States, you have a double burden. And you have a triple burden if you're a lesbian and Black. And so it takes a tremendous act of courage to open yourself to someone who's expressing interest and curiosity. Because in this society, if you're Black and gay, you get hurt too often.
Agreed completely. So it sounds like y'all are doing fantastic work down there at UCI.
It's a work in progress, but I appreciate it.
y'all have come a long way and actually a role model for a lot of institutions of higher ed. So with that being said, you have had lots of successes. So, but what does success mean to you? How do you define success?
You know, I had a brother who just passed away. And part of the grieving process, and I'm still going through it, is making sense of our relationship. And one thing that this process has taught me is how he helped me grow. He had gifts, and I was a beneficiary of those gifts. And so success for me looks at creating a university, a campus, an office that supports people. And so that means, you know, we admitted a record number of Black California high school seniors. That's success. And it's so gratifying because the admission rate is below 18%. Right? Hmm. It's success when we hire a new Black faculty member. But it's not enough just to hire. We have to scaffold their success, just like we do for the student. And I can't stress this. Success is also seeing our Black staff thrive, who are overwhelmingly women.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And often aren't faculty, but staff. And so ensuring that they thrive. And so it's not about me, it's about seeing other people thrive, because the bottom line is more people need to thrive.
Agreed. Thank you so much, Vice Chancellor, for joining us tonight. It has been a fantastic and very informative interview.
Well, thank you. And I don't want to leave.
I know. I wish we could dig deeper. Give us right. the nuggets of how these institutions need to do it.
Well, I tell you what, go to the Black Thriving website. It's part of the Office of Inclusive Excellence. And there on the first page, you'll see the three reasons why the campus decided to embark on Black Thriving. And I just want to note that those reasons are important,
mm-hmm.
right? We are an academic community. We live in a world of ideas. We're making an argument about Black thriving based on ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to thank you for your time, for having me, for welcoming me. And, you know, I'm going to be listening.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you. We really do. This has been probably one of the most informative interviews we've done in a while. And it really makes you think, where were we, where are we, and where are we going?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Create that legacy of brilliant Black thriving.
Correct.
Absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to Scratching and Thriving Podcast, featuring Vice Chancellor Haynes from UCI.